Towards the Lies. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week, that would be through the end of The Trouble with Peace. We're also going to be talking about the original trilogy and other things like that in here, so I highly recommend that you've read everything up until this point. Beyond that, we are sponsored by Beer is the Mind Killer, an excellent little Etsy shop. Highly recommend checking them out for all your nerdy merch. I'm actually wearing, right before I go to this concert festival, the Beer is the Mind Killer shirt. It's a lovely little shirt that says, drink beer, read fantasy, read more fantasy. So highly recommend. Great little puff painty kind of deal. You can use the code MADNESS at checkout to get 10% off and more. Hey there, this is Cross, and this is Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We generally tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of this show as your intoxicating weekly book club, but this week, we're doing things a little bit different again for a second time. This week, I'm here to wrap up my Trouble with Peace thoughts in the best way that I know how, a bit of a rant and ramble about two of my favorite characters, King Orso the First and Leo Dan Brock. Okay, one favorite character and another minor scoundrel, but nonetheless. As a reminder, I recommend that you've read up through the entirety of The Trouble with Peace at this point. It's definitely a necessity, and I would not skip out on this book. It's such a good one. That said, we'll kick it off with a quote from Leo that he often cites from his father throughout this book and throughout previous novels thus far. He often cites him claiming, he has said, in battle, his father always told him, is where a man finds out who he truly is. And this is sort of Leo's guiding principle, but to call it that is almost laughable. I don't know if I can so much call this a principle as it is like the single bone in this boy's body. But to kind of get into it a little bit more here, the idea of today's episode is going to be comparing and contrasting Leo and Orso again here, just to give you kind of the outlay. So to talk about this pair of characters is to talk about their place and their thoughts as they pertain and rotate around their own stations in life. Orso wants nothing more than to surrender his throughout our first two novels, while our champ, Leo, is champing at the bit to get his next taste of power and authority. While power isn't the thing that drives him to rebellion in our second book here, as he doesn't see Orso himself as a threat, naively believing that he could remain on the throne while throwing out the old bathwater that is the closed council, he does need to exercise the power that he does have, and that is his own perceived and real military might. To put it kindly, Leo is politically imprudent at the best of times, and at his worst, he messes nearly everything up. While he does improve over the course of this novel from his negotiation with Stour, he doesn't really succeed at politicking so much as Stour sees the benefit through his incompetence at negotiating. Orso, meanwhile, puts together others' schemes easily when faced. At the end of a little hatred, with the betrayal of Lord Isher, he proudly puts on a smile, grins, and bears it, knowing that in the long run there will be some form of political comeuppance. He also seems to know how to handle Yoru Sulphur, despite detesting him in the stranglehold that Valentin Balk has on the crown, and manages it all well, despite his, you know, usual flourish and bluster. This leads us, however, to Styria. Our adventure into Italy that isn't starts with a pair of matching chapters titled Grown Up, Grown Up, giving us different perspectives from where these two rulers are in their lives as they enter the neutral, albeit still distinctly Styrian territory of Sapani. Leo is having a party, a bit of a bachelor stag weekend, but instead is very self-serious with his friends in what he doesn't realize is their last bash before he loses another pair of them to his brash decision-making. He can't think past what needs to be done next, knowing full well what's at stake with his meeting with Jappo Mercato. Meanwhile, Orso is getting ahead of things himself, proving himself to be more kingly and fitting of his station than many might have assumed, moving his mother to Sapani, where she can be safe with his sister. He's also put on the spot, and as she says that he's grown up and is far more serious and kingly. To put it to a quote from his own mouth, "Well, I'm not him." Though he feared, in fact, he might be. It's brought out the responsible servant of the people in me, as he reflects on his father and their father, rather, and their time that they had with him and whether or not he was a good ruler. Both of our characters also have doting mothers that are sidelined over the course of their sons' lives. And I believe both in this book, if not, Finry may have been sidelined at the end of A Little Hatred. I'm forgetting the precise details there necessarily in this exact moment. But regardless, they're sidelined in very different ways here. Orso manages it with a tact that Leo has entirely failed to catch. He has a plan for her, and this is directly and explicitly for Queen Therese's safety and for once to allow her some small bit of kindness in the form of her longtime true love, Queen Chalair. That said, we'll move into all tastes, no judgments. If there was one thing Leo valued, it was honesty, and Cardotti's House of Leisure might have been the most dishonest place in the world. I think that this is one of the best examples of the differences, obviously, between these two characters as we see them actually go through the physical steps with Joppo and be put through their paces. So as their trip to Sapani goes, we find Leo facing down the son of the Snake of Tollens, and the Northman shivers the first, and it goes poorly. As he thinks over the course of these pair of chapters, Leo compares himself to Northman frequently, but fails to observe that he sees himself in the ideals of them, not recognizing that he fails to live up to those standards that he aspires to. And it's all idyllic. Leo holds many ideals. The ideal of rebellion, ideals of honor, ideals of the Northman, ideals of the warrior, ideals of the hero, all instilled in him in part by his father, in part by society, but mostly by his own expectation of what he aspires to be. This seems to extend to his sexuality as well, repressing attraction consistently, but especially with Joppo, as he views the whole thing as a perversion here and further down the line. This, in my estimation, is his core flaw: ideals over reality, and the cost it extracts on Leo himself is a grave one. On a little bit of a different angle, Tunny is known to be more prudent than anything else and says something insightful here as Leo is talking with Joppo and having left Orso down at the gambling tables. Orso says, "Why is it always the bastards who get all the luck?" And Tunny replies, "Winning teaches you nothing," said Tunny. "You see what a man really is when he loses." And this is a practical premonition, as Leo also comes to these terms by the end of the novel, inverting his father's frequent saying. We'll get to that in a little bit here. But it is a fascinating approach and thought as far as, you know, bastards and the luck. It's especially funny to me, considering there's a high probability that this is a bastard throne in many ways, given Giselle's sort of nature. But we'll work that out more precisely, you know, in our final book here. There's another bit of insight into how they both think of this lion mask wearing man as Orso confronts the greeter at the door, saying, "Being an asshole is crime and punishment both." That said, Orso has little space for ideals outside of chatting with them over drinks. He chooses often what's best and most prudent to help and save the money, the people, towards the goal of maintaining and improving the present status quo. If there's one thing that Leo valued, with all this in mind, Orso tends into his conversation with Joppo with a very different tact. He tends away from vengeance, another trait that the series, by and large, has pointed out as useful, but often a bad thing to hold on for. The uselessness of feuds even follows and shows angles between Leo, Orso, and Joppo as they live in this weird triangle of vengeance between them. Leo being unwilling to bend to give anything more that he possibly could have bent because of the sexuality and the approach that Joppo has, wherein Orso has nothing but respect for the man and is willing to offer whatever is necessary outside of Sapani, of which is not something that he can likely give anyway. There's just an honesty in what they can offer and what they can't offer as well that is refreshing from that perspective. That said, there's a great quote here that I want to read that I think gives us a ton of perspective on Joppo and Orso. So, King Joppo filled Orso's glass, then tapped a loose drop from the edge of the decanter. "So, what has brought you all the way across the Circle Sea?" "Treason," Orso said simply. "I may be facing another serious rebellion, and these rebels may be seeking your help. I want to convince you not to give it." "You are frank. I expect your position, like mine, gives you limited time to relax. I would not presume to take up more of it than necessary." "How thoughtful. Good manners are a gift that costs nothing. If only the young lion saw things that way." Orso paused. Plainly, that had been no slip of the tongue. "You have met with Lord Brock, then?" It was a heavy blow, but hardly a surprising one. Orso wondered whether Savine knew it, whether she had helped plan it. Even now, the thought gave him a stab of pain so sharp he could barely hide it. Perhaps I've been approached about joining, let's call it a confederation. Conspiracy strikes an ugly note, doesn't it? Awfully tasteless, said Orso, sucking thoughtfully on the pipe and letting the smoke curl away. A confederation based on freedom, patriotism, and high principles. Awfully tasteful. Just what a lovely comparison of conversation between the two characters here as they are able to jape at each other very simply versus the very boring and pointed conversation that's had between Leo and Joppo as well. Again, the politicking getting the better of him in those moments, as well as being made uncomfortable by the sexuality, by the drugs, by alcohol, you know, strictly a warrior in so many ways, but unable to live up to the ideals of being a general, which is something that he reflects on even later in this novel. With Savine in bed. So it's just a very interesting sort of setup as these people are actually able to have conversations as kings, and the aspiring leader is no more than a figurehead in many ways. And it's funny that Leo embodies a figurehead considering he is nothing but ideals anyway. So this eventually gives way to our chapters led by confrontation, starting with the variously titled ground chapters. Most important among them, despite laying out the battlefield very plainly for us, is the common ground chapter. Leo finds himself with an opportunity to potentially make peace, while Orso, at a minimum, is playing for time with a small chance at parley underlying the proceedings. Orso takes the reins of the conversation and keeps it firmly in his hands the whole time. There are many examples of him just using the food and the conversation with Bernil, the chef, and the idea about like the soup and everything else to kind of push him over the edge, and whether or not they take drink, and the friends that are with him and accompanying him as well. There's just a whole lot of sort of clever banter that Orso has laid out to sort of disarm him. And disarm him he does. He almost successfully defangs him. One little fun line that I love from this is, no, it's the small cutlery, Leo, as the fish is served. It's just such a fun bit where clearly Leo reached for the fork and grabbed the wrong one and just doesn't have the decorum or the presence to actually manage to even be or present kingly. He's simply a warrior. I think that this just further demeans in a very subtle way. So, all told, Leo is holding together well, even considering Orso's words, until he strikes something that leaves him on an uneven keel, that of the mention of his wife, Savine. Being that she and Orso were once lovers, jealousy flares within him and takes over, replacing any rational thought that he might have been approaching with a childish rage. Orso is almost shocked, considering the meal isn't over, and he himself is as over as he can be about Savine's rejection, it feels like. So the whole reaction comes off as more than Orso intended in his own politicking of the moment. I think, in addition to being surrounded here by two and not four of his friends, he's also uncomfortable in his sexuality here, as though internally measuring himself against Orso. A literal mental dick measuring contest. And that's really brought to head, I think, next in Savine's chapter, where we hop into her head and he's uncertain of just about everything. This lack of clarity is critical. This man, Leo Danbrock, wants to stand for something. He wants to be a painting. He wants to be a statue on the Kingsway. But at best, he's a sketch half penciled in to resemble a hero. The worst for him is yet to come. That said, I shouldn't strictly hate on Leo, but there is another comparison point that lends itself to this conversation between these two leaders. Leo has a deep care for the ornamentation of the Union and what it stands for. Again, its idyllic state, as a country that meant something once. He is, in fewer words, a staunch patriot who cares for the symbols of the Union. Meanwhile, Orso has long since been disaffected with what the Union should be and stand for, instead seeing the machine as it turns inside, and really wants nothing more than to understand what it can do, what's possible within the trappings of society as it stands. These dueling ideologies are used by the smart against the smarmy, the brain against the brawn, as Orso sets and baits his trap with a steadfast standard in cold blood for the lion's ultimate defeat in heroics. I do love, there's a little quote here within Cold Blood where he realizes that he is going to actually be on the battlefield and wants to be on the battlefield as well. He says, "Training, talent, or experience would only be an encumbrances to a monarch. Such petty concerns are for the little people, my dear." From the window, he could see the low ridge to the east of the town, the spindly trees on top, a faint hint of dawn showing in the clouds behind. I don't think I can put it off any longer. When the sun comes up, I'm going to have to bloody fight. And it's such a good look at who Orso is. We know that he's a talented fencer, and all of these different pieces are just encumbrances to him. And we see that very directly through Leo. It is an encumbrance to Leo to be skilled in all of these other arenas, because he then believes that he needs to exercise them in so many different ways, which then pairs really nicely against the Men of Angland speech, which comes after little people and a lot of things have gone really sideways throughout this whole section. This is from Heroics. So, "Men of Angland," he roared, raised his sword high. "Are you with me?" Few of them could have heard the words, but they got the gist, shoving their lances at the spitting heavens, letting go a rousing cheer. "For Leo Dan Brock," roared Antaup. "For the young lion," bellowed Jin. Leo took his place behind them at the sharp edge of the wedge, where he'd longed to be ever since Isher first mentioned rebellion, ever since Savine made it a reality, ever since he was last here, where he belonged, the very point of the spear. He lifted the rim of his shield and used it to snap down his visor. "Forward," he roared, though it couldn't have been more than a metallic burble outside of his helmet, and he gave his horse the spurs. So, a great little quote here to kind of demonstrate the idea that Leo must be in the front, and this is something that Jurind would have warned against. This is something that Savine did say was ultimately unnecessary, but he dismissed again because he also is sexist in addition to racist and homophobic a bit. You know, especially the sexism is less than the rest, but, you know, regardless, it's a bit of a mess here on Leo's behalf. In the end, the man loses and Leo's charge is broken. Leo is stuck using his sword like the crutch that it is and like the crutch that it's been for him. I mean this in multiple contexts, not just the fact that he is literally crutching along on the sword, but that his entire life has been crutching by the sword. He hasn't needed to be anything else. And I think that this is something that Joe is pointing at very explicitly here, as we find the man broken, his arm completely worthless, a leg amputated shortly hereafter. I mean, it's just been holding him up in so many different contexts. And now, in order to live in this world, he's going to have to be something different. Leo has been a princeling by every other measure, no better than Guslav's sons from the original trilogy, and in many ways, completely unworthy to the throne that he doesn't necessarily seek, but that he aspires to be capable of holding, or that he aspires, keeps in his mind as this sort of idealism. Again, Leo doesn't necessarily want to be the king, but he is being positioned by everyone else to be the king. And as a component of that, I think it's important to note that he is, in the end, incredibly unworthy, not only because he lost and this rebellion is put down, but also because he's a miserable SOB anyway. Orso, meanwhile, has a very different reflection after the battle. While he might have been the victor, he also can't help but feel like the loser simultaneously. During the chapter, The New Harvest, he looks on, thinking, "It was a surprise, in a way, to hear that the birds still sang, to see the sun still rose and the wind still blew. But things go on." Orso took a long breath that had a faint, sickening tang of battle about it. "Things always go on," he murmured. "Not for everyone, mind you. The dead were everywhere, sparsely dotted, away to the north, then more liberally sprinkled where the fighting had been fiercest, clogged up in knots. Heaps, almost. Perhaps men had felt the need to crawl towards other men while they still had the breath. Perhaps even the dead love company." And this is a thought that then eventually leads him to go actually talk to Leo and sort of have this conversation between the two of them. And he's left a completely broken wreck, right? Again, to quote here, "Cruelty to a man so utterly broken in body and spirit did not help Orso in the least. It just made him feel cruel. He could be generous in victory, couldn't he? He had won, hadn't he? So why did he feel like he lost?" "My friends," croaked out Brock. His eyes looked a little wet. Perhaps that was from the agony. "Dead," said Orso. Brock bared his teeth as he tried to shift back on his bed. They were pink with blood still. "Can I ask that they get a decent burial, at least?" "In a pit with the rest. I've hundreds of loyal men to bury. I can waste no effort on traitors." Bloody hell, he hated this. He stood, shoving back his chair, and turned towards the door. "They were good men," he heard Brock whisper. For some reason, it made Orso exceptionally angry. Good men and bad, they're all meat now. If it's any consolation, you won't need to worry about it for long. Your hanging's within the week. And he strode for the door with his fists clenched. Orso, despite having won, feels like he lost. Would Leo feel the same in this moment? Is he capable of understanding the complications of winning? He only sees his pride and his loss in the battle and sees himself as a footnote to history for now. It's an interesting place that we're left in here with Leo and Orso. I mean, obviously, yet to come is the absolute mercy that Orso shows this crippled man in sparing him and potentially sending him off to camp for life, which is obviously a pain in and of itself, but it's something that he can't live to see done after his confrontation with Savine that happens, in which she finally reveals to him the truth that they were siblings, and that was the only reason that he said no. And so at that point, Leo seems more like a second prize than a first choice in many regards. And I think that that combination with everything else sort of softens him to the man just a little bit. It makes for a really complex talking point between these two men. Orso and Leo Dan Brock are both complicated men with uncomplicated desires in many ways. Leo is aspiring to power, and Orso is kind of shoving off power in many regards. So it makes for an interesting comparison. There's no more that Orso wants, and Leo is getting everything that he wants in many regards up until this point in the story, in which we see fortunes and fates reversed in many ways. A little thought here to maybe end this portion of the episode before, you know, outroing and whatnot, but Leo Dan Brock died on that battlefield. Is it possible that he can rise from the ash after accepting the king's mercy? After all, as Leo reflects, after the battle is when a man finds out who he truly is. All that said, with the conflict settled and torches lingering in the background, burning flames licking at the horizon, warning us of what's to come next, what is going to come next? Next week, we are going to be beginning The Wisdom of Crowds, the final book in this trilogy, the final book of the First Law. Very excited to talk about it with everyone over the coming weeks. We've since also very recently recorded our final wrap-up episodes, and it's been an absolute joy to get to cover the series on the whole. Sorry that this one was a little late. Hope you guys enjoyed it nonetheless. You can interact with us on social media. You can find us, Words of Whiskey Pod, anywhere that you can find us on social media, mostly Threads and Blue Sky and Instagram. Those are our predominant lanes. You can join us on patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. This prompt was actually in part voted on by our patrons because I really wasn't quite sure what I wanted to cover for this book in particular. I had said Leo, and I think that Leo made a lot of sense as we see sort of this old power-hungry Leo die, but they contributed the Orso angle and as such gave me a perfect comparison, I think, between the two to give us these two aspiring leaders and what they stand for and kind of talk through their different places in the story. So join us, patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. It's a great little community. We talk about the books. We talk about all kinds of other books. We're all very excited as well for the new Lit Escalates announcement of the Book of Lorne and everything that's coming over there. So chances are good we'll be covering that on the Patreon, I imagine, in some capacity as well. So very excited. Yeah. Beyond that, leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts, and we'll see you next week.